So, good morning, everyone, and welcome back to our Labyrinth Chenmo class and the unit we're doing on the perfection of generosity. So, let's begin as we normally do by setting our motivation and setting up a visualization. So, make yourself comfortable in this seat, meaning make sure that your back is straight and your shoulders relaxed. And breathing normally and naturally, and becoming aware of the breath at the level of the belly. So, this way you feel completely embodied in the natural act of breathing. And while you're breathing normally and naturally, imagine that from the 10 directions of space, the spiritual lineage of all the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas of the 10 directions appear in your room, slightly above your head and in front of you. And feel as if you are sitting within a vast crowd of all sentient beings. And while in that crowd, recollect that everyone equally wishes to avoid suffering, equally wishes to be happy, and equally lack genuine happiness. Furthermore, we are equal in that for everyone, the causes of suffering can be eliminated, and the potential for complete, genuine happiness abides within us. To accomplish complete, genuine happiness, we need all the causes of suffering. And this abandonment begins with our first abandonment, which is an attachment to the fantasies of just this life. Then we need to abandon attachment to all the pleasures of cyclic existence, attachment to our own singular welfare, and finally to grasping at an independent and objective reality. And by doing so, we can turn our mind and the minds of everyone to the truth. And to practice the truth as a path, removing obstacles on it, and purifying confusion into wisdom. And since only the three jewels and the Lama are indivisible, and protect that effect with us. Decide to help everyone engage in the path as explained by your teacher and the lineage. So with this wish, think that from the central figure in the refuge field in front of you, from the heart of Shakyamuni Buddha, an emanation moves through space and comes to abide above the crown of your head. He's facing in the same direction as us towards the merit field. And decide now to refresh refuge from the depths of your heart. And we can do this by reciting the refuge prayer together and generating the mind of enlightenment. So let's do that together. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, May I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. Now, to stabilize this wish and to increase it, we will recite the four immeasurable thoughts together. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Now, the accomplishment of the path can be summed up in what we need to abandon and what we need to adopt. And what we need to abandon is everything that holds us back from accomplishing the path. And we need to accumulate as much merit as possible to accomplish the path also. This is all summed up in the seven limb prayer, so we'll recite that together. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since the beginning of this time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. So now, to accomplish our wishes, we'll make an offering of a mandala to the merit field in front of us. So I think that here we're offering our body, speech, mind, and our merits. And all this transforms into a wonderful land whereby all beings can take teachings from. So this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this is a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamiryatayami. So now imagine that the Buddha and the merit field smile at you in delight and accept the offering. Then the merit field dissolves into light and absorbs into the Buddha above the crown of your head. This Buddha, who is in essence your own teacher, descends through space, entering the crown of your head, must rest at the level of your heart, and then the light of his body begins to increase, filling your body. The light moves out through the pores of your skin, going out into the 10 directions of space. Wherever there are living beings within that space, they are touched by that light and transformed, becoming fully awakened. So this time the boundaries of your body and the outside world have completely vanished. A sense of us and them has also vanished. Now, the light that pervades the 10 directions of space, full of all enlightened qualities, begins to withdraw, coming back into your heart. So think that your own mind has been blessed by all the wisdom, compassion, and power of the Buddhas. Acknowledge that you're able to listen to these teachings, reflect upon them, and put them into practice. And then feel embodied, sitting on your seat, breathing normally and naturally, but with an intention to fully awaken for the benefit of others. And in your own time, just allow your attention to be brought back to the room and we'll begin the class. So here we're up to class four, and a lot of this material we've covered previously in the Labyrinth Chinmaya class. So I know a lot of you are new here. So I think it's fine. There's nothing really difficult to understand about this material. But we've also covered some stuff. So we looked at the meaning of paramita. So paramita is a Sanskrit word. It means going beyond the end or reaching perfection. And the paramitas or the perfections are practiced within the Pali and Sanskrit traditions. And these paramitas or perfections are normally numbered as 10, but they are often condensed into the 6 that we are familiar with. And these 6 perfections are the means to attain awakening ourselves to help others. Now, at present, we're engaged in the study of the first perfection, and this is called the perfection of generosity or the perfection of charity. And it has many benefits. The major benefit that comes about through practicing the perfection of charity is to put in place the potential to accumulate the resources we need as we engage in the path. So some of you might have sadhanas to practice, and which means basically you've had a highest yoga tantric initiation. So you might notice in your sadhana that there are lots of instances of making offerings in them. And the major reason for doing that is so that you do have the resources if you don't attain enlightenment in another life. So just suppose in the next life you've practiced well enough to have a fortunate human rebirth, but you did not accomplish your liberation, you didn't accomplish enlightenment. So in that life as a human being with leisure and opportunity, you would have, resources like we have now. So we'd have good clothing, a good house, good family to grow up in, access to Dharma and so forth. So all of these resources come about through practicing charity in this life and in previous lives. Now, there are lots of obstacles that arise to the practice of charity or generosity, but there are antidotes that we can apply. Now, the major obstacle to the practice of the perfection of generosity is psychological, meaning we really want to hold on to things. So our obstacles are things like miserliness, stinginess, and attachment. But like I said, these three obstacles can be overcome with their antidotes. And the antidotes to stinginess, miserliness, and attachment come about through really reflecting on the faults of these three and then contemplating the good results that come about from sharing. So it really takes a repeated analysis of both before we can actually have or generate a spontaneous desire to give. So we're in a section called beginning development. In other words, you're beginning to develop the intention to perfectly give. And within the section, there are a number of different divisions. And we have looked at the divisions from the point of view of an ordained person and from the point of view of a lay person. And in this class today, we're just going to sort of go along and keep examining the way to develop the perfection of charity for a lay person. Oh, sorry, for the, just for the, well, for anyone. Okay, so let's have a look at some of the material I've called upon. So at present, I'm using these two books are called The Great Treatise on the Stages of the Path to Enlightenment. So that's the one with called the Lamrim Chenmo on the bottom there. And the book above it called Steps on the Path to Enlightenment. And there's another text that I can't show you because it's was a commentary given by Khyentse Rinpoche Geshe Tashi Tserin. So I've been drawing on those three up to this point. I'll keep doing that, but I'll also bring in material from the other texts as well. So today's topic, we're really going to look at these the divisions of actual generosity. And you can see here these divisions are, there are three. There's a division into teaching, so how to what that means, fearlessness, and the material things. So, Ari Shantideva, the writer of The Bodhisattva's Way of Life, has said in chapter one, a fantastic chapter on the practice of generosity. He says, the thought to give all beings everything, together with the fruits of this, is said to be the perfection of generosity. Thus, it is simply a state of mind. So generosity, being generous, does not mean that we can abolish all the poverty in the world. What it really requires from us is to have a wish to give. So even though we might lack the resources to give, it still does not stop us having a wish to give. And that's really what we need to generate within us. Now, here we come to these divisions of actual generosity that I talked about. So what I'm going to do is just talk a little bit about each of them, and then we'll move into the a more in-depth explanation of each of them. So first was the first division called giving teachings, the generosity of giving teachings. So in brief, this really means teaching the sublime teaching, and without making mistakes. But it also means teaching the arts and the like, which means basically worldly occupations which are blameless and proper to learn. And also involving others in upholding the precepts. The gift of fearlessness, this means is really basically the gift of protection, of giving refuge, protecting living beings from fear. So there are different types of fear. So there are many of us who fear other human beings, so we try to protect people from others. But people can also be afraid of animals and insects and so forth, so we try and protect them. But also, people are also afraid of the weather. As you probably know, some people are also very afraid of open spaces and others are afraid of really closed in spaces. So we try to do whatever we can to alleviate their sense of fear. And then we have the giving of material gifts. This is sort of broken up into two divisions, but we'll talk about those as we come to them. Now, there are also other forms of generosity that are not mentioned within the Lamrim Chenmo. So these other forms of generosity are mentioned within the practices of the Tantras. So I'll just, some of you might not have had initiations, but some of you I know have. So I'd just like to bring these to your attention. So one of them is called the generosity of giving love. So this includes volunteering in social welfare projects. And it also, from the point of view of Tantra, we're really talking about our wish for others to be happy and to have the causes of happiness. So we're going to give whatever is required. Just that wish is the giving of love. We also, of course, are going to try and do what we can to make sure that others are happy and are able to generate within their own mental continuums causes for happiness. Now there's one other sort of generosity, and this is probably one you're not familiar with, at least in terms of the name. It's called the generosity of giving our equanimity to others. The generosity of giving our equanimity to others. So in Tantra, the giving protection from fear has this further interpretation. In other words, others have nothing to fear from us, because we're not going to cling to them with desirous attachment, or reject them with anger and hostility, or ignore them with naivety. But we'll be open to everybody. So they have nothing to fear from us. Nothing. We don't have to worry that we're going to cling to them, reject them, or ignore them. Okay, so now we're going to now go into the next three slides, where we talk about the generosity of giving teachings, giving fearlessness, and giving the material gifts. So in brief, the generosity of giving teachers is to do this, to teach others with a pure motivation. So in the Geshe Sopra's book, he says, the gift of Dharma is to teach others with a non-perverted motivation. So I know that some of you have got your, I can see most of you, and I also see that you've got your microphones off. Would anybody like to have a guess or have some idea of what a perverted motivation might be?
Eddie, so if you want to just stop the screen share, then we can see everybody and they can wave their hand at you. And...
Oh, okay. So
so go up to the chair, top.
Yep.
Stop share.
Here I am, and I can see all you, and you can see me.
So then to coordinate it, you can just kind of wave your hand if you've got an idea of what was the question again, Eddie?
Well, Geshe Sopra says that the gift of Dharma is to teach others with a non-perverted motivation. So what I'm asking is, what do you think a perverted motivation might be? Because that's the one we want to avoid. And it might be simpler to understand that. Any ideas?
So Chris Lumley had his hand up first.
Okay, so Chris, what do you have to say?
Yeah, good morning all. I think that would be an attitude that is imbued with a gain for self and believing that things actually inherently exist, Eddie. That would be my contribution.
So gaining for oneself and based on a view of inherent existence.
Bruce also had his hand up.
Yeah, Bruce, what have you got to say?
Yeah, pretty similar to what Chris said. Basically, doing it with the motivation to gain respect or you know, gain from the person you're providing the teaching to.
Yeah, okay, that's great. Anyone else?
Jeanette, did you have your hand up too? Oh, you've got to unmute, darling.
Oh, that's the video off.
Oh, where's Jeanette? She can't see her and she's got her thing on.
Oh, yep.
I'm still doing a how-to about this thing.
That's okay, we can hear you.
Yeah. Well, I was just thinking the same as what Bruce said, where you're more interested in what you can gain from it.
Yeah, and what is it that we could gain from it by giving these teachings to others? What do you think that is?
Well, I mean, one of the biggest ways you can kind of corrupt your own teachings is by thinking, oh, that's not enough money for it. I should be getting more money, and then getting disgruntled about if you're not getting enough money for it.
Yeah, that's another thing. So I think this can sort of be summed up that if you teach with the attitude of the eight worldly concerns, if you like teaching out of praise, or if you want others to praise you, you want others to respect you, you want to be held in high esteem by them, that you also wish to make a living out of it.
Yeah, that's a really tricky one with the Dharma if you don't have any other income. And I know it's kind of this kind of ethical things kept me honest whenever I've gone up to Chenrezig Institute and led a course up there. And sometimes they've made a huge money offering, and other times they've made like a totally minuscule money offering, and I've had to make sure that I have exactly the same emotional response to either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you'll see too, as we go through this, when we teaching the Dharma, the category we're within, it can be for lay people and for the ordained. And that teaching Dharma doesn't actually require us to be like in a position like what we are like now, right? So I'm trying to explain to you the perfection of generosity, and everybody's up at home on their screens and they're learning some sort of imparting Dharma as best I can. So that's not the only way, of course, that lay people impart the teachings of Dharma. Like, for instance, if you work at a school as a counsellor or even as a parent, trying to help your children or people that you have some responsibility towards, if you can bring in your understanding of Dharma, like one of the things you want to do, of course, is you don't want to hurt them. So that should be the first thing. We're going to restrain ourselves from hurting the person we are talking to. So any sort of just, what we call ordinary advice that will help them be happier people and to avoid suffering. So that's giving Dharma.
Is that also tie in with what you said about to give without kind of the concern of whether people will like you or not?
Yeah, this is right. Yeah, so for so many of you who have children, when they were little, they probably didn't like your advice, and now as they're older, they still don't like it. But we try to do what we can to help them, right? Because we love them. So when they don't take it, of course, do your best not to cling to their responses and have a sort of bad emotional response ourselves. So we're not doing it to be liked or to be held in esteem by anyone. We're doing it to help them. So, in other words, we are teaching whatever will be of to others' benefit. Now, whether you are in the position I'm in at present, or whether you are at home, or whether you're at your school, or whether you're at work. You know, we can be, our generosity is sort of like sharing what we understand of Dharma, in a sort of a, without going, hey, I'm a Buddhist and I'm, you know, going to tell you something that's really good for you. So, the gift of the teachings is therefore not necessarily an explanation of the scriptures. So it can be experiential advice that indirectly leads to emancipation. So when I use the term emancipation, what I'm saying is that, you know, everybody wishes to be free from suffering. Everybody wishes to avoid suffering. So you can help them, like you're saying here, indirectly. In other words, without letting them know that, you know, this is the Dharma, or I'm a Dharma practitioner, or something, or this is what the Buddha said. You know, we can just naturally be, for instance, kind, open to their problems, listen to them, give them advice that is meaningful and useful here. So I remember I've got a good friend who's a Buddhist practitioner, and his wife and children, of course, aren't. And whenever he would try to, they'd come home with their problems or something, and he would say something, and they would just shut down pretty much immediately. Because I'd always think, look, Dad, you know, that we don't want to hear what your Buddhist stuff, what you've got to say about Buddhism. They'd always come at him like that. So he had to be... it really got him shut out of quite a few conversations with his family, actually. So he had to sort of really adjust his speaking style to his family.
So, Eddie, this is what I call stealth Dharma.
Yeah, well, I mean, before we became Buddhist, we were trying to help the people we loved and cared for, weren't we? We were always trying to do that. So it's basically saying the same sort of thing. By trying to do that, this is the generosity of giving the teaching. So Geshe Sopa says, out of love and compassion, one can teach in many ways and on many levels to help others who are under the power of the disturbing emotions. Any instruction that aids others' progress towards happiness or liberation is given the gift of the teachings. So once again, he says, it's not referring only to teaching or translating or transcribing teachings, or making books available, or making stupas and all of that. Even, like, for instance, being in a Dharma center, for instance, and when new people come and they don't know where to sit, or where the library is, or where the toilets are, or anything like that, if you help them, this is generosity, it's like be included within the teaching. Yeah, giving them any type of information they need. Now, in the Sakya tradition, there's also an offering called the offering of Samadhi. Now, Samadhi is concentration. Yeah? So what this is referring to is giving others all the different aspects of our practice. So everything that we've read or studied, we offer that to others, and we use that to help them.
Eddie, what do you mean that we offer it to others, like in our mind or by
You can do it in two ways. One is within your mind, but the other thing is just to offer it verbally. So this, I guess it's just a sort of like a different term. But in other words, so, you know, for most of us engaged in the practice of Dharma, we sort of have to concentrate on this material. And when others ask us Dharma questions that we're sort of, unsure of, but we have the information, but we've got to sort of dredge it up. You know, like we might be sitting there and someone asks us something And we sort of know, oh yeah, I know the answer to that, but like what is it? I got to get it. So you have to sort of like slow down and concentrate and like draw it up, don't you? And then you offer them that, what you understand of the Dharma. So that's what they call the offering of samadhi, the offering of concentration. Rupi's going to the...
Rachel has a question.
Oh, okay. Rachel, what have you got to ask?
Sorry. So does the offering of samadhi go under giving teachings?
Yes, it does.
Yeah. So what tradition was that from again?
That's from the Shakya lineage.
Shakya lineage. Yeah. Okay. And they just like sort of put it on a slightly different category or...
That's what they call it. The offering of samadhi. So you know, all these lineages have got different ways of setting out the perfections. So, you know, when the very first class we started, I basically let you guys know that there are different names for these perfections, and within each of them, they categorize them different under different names and so forth. So what I'm trying to do here is present it mainly from the Galupa tradition, like from Lama Tsongkhapa's presentation, but then bring in other aspects that you might not be familiar with, just so that we get a much broader view of the teaching. And then if you ever hear, I mean, like my friend is a Shakya practitioner, for instance, the one who I said had difficulties with his family imparting Dharma. So this would be, yeah, when he studies his texts, it wouldn't be, I mean, he does look at the Lama and Tenma, of course, but he also has texts within the Shakya tradition of the path and how it's presented. So within that presentation, we'd have this here called the generosity of samadhi. That's included within the generosity of giving teachings.
Eddie, Rosemary has a question about would the offering of focused attention be an offering of samadhi?
Yep, so by that I guess it's like when you're focused on the person who is asking the questions or the person that you wish to impart the information to, and that the fact that you've drawn it up and are able to give it. So you are the one concentrating, found the answer, imparted it, and you also wish that they would have the ability to concentrate themselves and draw up the Dharma. Mm-hmm. Okay, shall we have a look at the next one?
Yep.
Okay. So giving protection from fear. So here we've got this fireman who's come down from a roof or a power pole and they've brought the little pussycat down. So in essence, giving protection from fear is the gift of protection or the gift of refuge. So I think in the in our examination questions, I asked, you know, what's the essence of the protection from fear? Or giving fearlessness, it's called. So there's protection. So this is related to whatever one does to alleviate others' fear is the practice of generosity, and a particular practice of giving fearlessness.
So Eddie, I'll jump in here and say our very own Venerable Lhasam is like exemplary about this, the way that she looks after all of the animals at Lungri Tungpa Center, the cat, the wildlife, the lizards, the birds, the possums, giving them all this protection and refuge.
So in this practice of giving fearlessness, giving protection from fear, means we can keep others from falling, ease their hunger or thirst, save their lives, shield them from harm, safeguard their wealth, shelter them from danger, and so on. The author suggests that we start with what we can do. So even saving an insect is the practice of giving protection. So I know for many of us, I don't know about this time of year, but later on you'll find all the ants will want to come inside and go for your sugar and whatever you've got on the tabletops. And I know myself that sometimes when I go and have a shower, like, you know, you go in there, somehow or other, there's, you know, a cockroach ends up in the bath around your feet. Or if you go to the sink to do the dishes, sometimes, at least here, a cockroach will come up through the drain itself. So I don't particularly like that happening. And I know in the past, you know, you just want to sort of squash them. So here, of course, it's like, don't do that. You know, avoid willingly taking the life of some other being. Try to protect them. So, you know, you'll probably be able to find something you can do any time during the day, especially when it comes to protecting others from fear. And especially this comes into if you have pets or run into insects or you're around small children. Or even if your children are going to school and they suddenly get freaked out because of the examinations. Now in Tibet, they used to have a system where they would help everybody practice this on Buddha's birthday, for instance. And I think in the West, we do the similar type thing. Well, Islam is open, has been encouraging us to do this. This is where you go out to buy animals that would be normally killed. You know, so for people, many buy lots of worms to use for fishing. So we go off to get the worms instead of having them be eaten by the fish. We release them somewhere. Other times you might go out and buy a lot of fish and release them yourselves in streams. But you have to be careful about that, as we found out, because we brought some fish one day and then released them in a creek. And then lo and behold, the council got in touch with us and asked us what we'd done. And this was not a thing to do. So you can be sort of careful and intelligent about it.
So, Eddie, also one of the great things that we can do that's set up so well is to be able to have, like, rescue animals. If we want to have an animal, get a rescue cat or a rescue dog or a rescue chicken.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, what else you can also do is if you have cats at home or any type of animal or even, like, you know, you could bring them here or at home, is walk them around a stupa, but protect them from the fears of future lives in the lower realms. That's a very simple thing you can do.
Robin says that she can kind of clearly see from this how the perfection of generosity ties also into right livelihood.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So, in Tibet, what they used to do, I think Lama Zopa still does it in Dharamsala and different places in America, where you'd go out and you might go and buy the yaks and the sheep that would be slaughtered by the butchers. And you would buy them. And then what he does, I've got some sort of sanctuary set up where he'd go and put the animals in there. And I've also read hot stories of His Holiness too, where he used to look down from the windows of the Potala Palace and he could see the people herding the sheep and things like that. And he'd just give money to one of his monks and say, go out and buy that herd and, you know, put him in a place where they couldn't be killed. So, yeah, saving the lives of animals that are to be slaughtered, releasing beings who are locked up in cages, saving flies that might be drowning in the swimming pool or the kitchen sink. So, of course, it doesn't have to be also, of course, from death itself. Of course, we want to do that. Like, for instance, our cat, he comes up on our bed and sleeps with us, and sometimes we put the quilt on him. So it's even just protecting the animals from cold or even protecting them from heat. So even this is a practice of helping animals to be less afraid and less uncomfortable. Protecting animals when they're being hunted, and also protecting children from all the different types of fears that they go through.
Eddie, can I ask you something?
Sure.
Can you hear me?
Yep, I can.
Willie went fishing last week up to Fraser Island for a week.
Yeah.
Just a total 7 days fishing, and he was using worms. And yeah. He was, you know, they put the hook through the worm's body.
Yes, they do. Yeah, that's right.
And I was horrified because I'd just read in Lama Zopa's book, The Six Perfections, that even Lama Zopa said something like that. People that do that, they don't have any.
Yeah.
They don't understand what they're really doing. But if I was to say to Willie, you shouldn't be doing this, he'd think I was crazy.
Yeah, that's right.
He loves fishing so much, there's nothing he would give up. You know, no way he would give it up. Even if I told him that it was the worst kind of karma he was building for himself.
Yeah, that's right. And this is just like my friend, where was, that's what his family would, you know, say, they'd say the same thing to him. So I was just thinking here, so if we approach like our husbands or our partners, like I'm saying, you know, just telling them straight off they shouldn't do that, the most likely response from them is to just sort of laugh at us, isn't it, or poo-poo it, or just go straight ahead.
Yeah, because they don't think animals have feelings.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Or insects or that. They just don't think they have feelings.
Yeah. So any ideas how we might be skillful with that? So, yeah, suppose, I guess the best outcome we could hope for here is that the person doesn't go out fishing altogether. Yeah? But let's suppose that's not going to happen. Like they dig their heels in and say, no, I love fishing and I'm going fishing. Now, that stuff's just all religious hoo-hoo. All right, so, yeah, okay, they're going fishing. Any ideas how we might be skillful about it? Because we've got two things here, isn't it? One is there's live bait on the hook, so there's a lot of suffering there, so that being is one thing that's going to die. The other thing is catching that fish and, you know, perhaps killing the fish also. So then we've got two beings who are going to die, and then we've got a person who's actually carrying that out, and then they're going to experience the karmic aftermath of taking the lives of other beings. And then there's also ourselves who... if we say nothing at all and know of the outcomes of that, then we also have some sort of karmic effect. It's quite different if we have no idea.
But so that show of, I can't remember the guy's name, but the show about river monsters.
That's what I'm thinking of.
Yeah, the biologist. So
just hold on, let everyone else have a go first, with me. Then we can bring up the river monsters. So anyone else, any ideas what you might do? So we're just asking this to help Jeanette, right?
Yeah. No, I wouldn't have an idea what to say to him now because it's his passion.
Yep, okay.
And he used to actually says to me, the fish don't feel it. I question him, I says, how would you like to have a hook put through your mouth?
Yeah, that's right.
And he says, yeah, but the fish don't feel it.
Yeah.
And I says, well, how do you know that they don't feel it? They've got flesh and blood the same as us. They must feel it.
Yep.
No, there's so, nothing you could...
I wondered if you could do some dedication where you ask for blessings that they're relieved of their suffering, whether it's the worms or the fish, so that... I mean, there could be something to do for the person, but maybe bringing it down to the beings that are going to be harmed in some way. A bit like when we dedicate food, thinking about all the sentient beings that have given up their lives so that we can eat. You know, whether it's we're eating meat or not, there's still sentient beings that have died for that.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, we can... I guess, use the make an offering of our practice.
Mm.
So it'll have a great outcome for us because we're practicing Dharma.
But it's not helping.
Anyone else? Okay, before you tell them about our man.
Has anyone seen the River Monsters, the show? He's a biologist and
he loves fishing.
He loves fishing and he goes to all of the different massive rivers in the world and tries to catch the most weird and wonderful, scary, incredible fish. Some of them, you know, as big as a human being. And so then he shows them like on the TV and says, what a magnificent, you know, creature. And then he lets them go again. So maybe Jeanette, you can encourage Willie to, you know, to enjoy his fishing, but to do the catch and release and ask, you know, ask him to do it for you. Make it really personal. Please do it for me. Catch the fish and release them.
Yes.
Yeah. So this is what I was thinking myself to, like, release the fish. Right? So that's good for the fish, right? Because the fish lives. What about the bait? Yep, Anne?
You could use the ones that aren't live. But...
That's right.
Finally.
That's right. So there are plenty of, they call them lures, don't they?
Yes.
This guy, the show that we watch, he uses all these different types of lures. Many times he uses a lure. And he catches the fish and he admires it and then he lets it go. So.
Yeah. Willie does use those lures from time to time, but there's only certain types of fish that can be caught with worms, that's the ones he wants. But he does let fish go from time to time, but the main point of it is to catch fish and eat them.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And there's a lot of fishermen like Willie Jeanette, and many of them have the attitude too that fish don't feel it. They're not like us. They don't have feelings. Of course, this has been disproven even from the science, from scientists, so disproven that. So that's not really a legitimate answer, but that's the answer we'll most likely get. So let's suppose, when we could try and get them to have a different, we try and get them to release the fish, we try and get them to have a different lure, then
you could also like ask Willie, like on special occasions, what do you want for your birthday? What I'd like is that you go out fishing and that you release all the fish on that day for me, my birthday.
Yeah. Or even on his birthday, he actually goes down to a shop and buys fish and releases them. Goes somewhere so where you can actually work against the taking of life and you actually protect life.
I'll put that to him.
Yep, that's especially when it's a special day for you, Jeanette.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he's actually got his 70th birthday coming up in a couple of weeks. Wow. So that would be a great idea for him to do that for his 70th birthday.
Yep. Okay. Now then.
Rosemary also said maybe take your husband to aquariums so he can see them as wonderful animals with personalities.
We have to. There's these, with this intention, isn't it? So when we do that, you bring in the intention yourself, Jeanette, to go, so you can actually see them as sentient beings who do not want to suffer and wish to be happy.
Mm. Yep.
Yeah.
Robin has a good idea that perhaps he could give money to organisations that protect waterways. Or the wildlife protection areas.
Yep. We've got to be skillful in this. Accept people where they are, but at the same time try and bring about some sort of indirect change.
So just on this too, Eddie, Robin said that the Japanese have a strong fishing culture, but they often show appreciation to the fish's life before eating, that at least reduces the attachment to killing, but I'm not so sure if you just show appreciation and then eat away.
No, there's just different karmas. You know, you have the karma of killing and then the karma of generosity. So the karma of killing is done, so you accumulate the fault of that. But in terms of the generosity, you know, you can do other things. So of course, you know, like if Willie brings home fish to eat, Jeanette, and you engage in the eating of that fish.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, but then you know, there we can use, this is where we can bring in what you suggested, Anne. You know, by imbibing the flesh of this animal, may it give me the strength to go on and save all sentient beings, just like this fish.
Yeah.
The other thing to do, of course, is when Willie goes off or somebody else goes off, if you know they're going to go fishing and take the lives out of it, they don't believe in the Dharma, then from our side as practitioners, we can do the giving and taking meditation. Right? So I think that, you know, may whatever karmas that Willie accumulates, may they ripen upon my own self-cherishing. Right? So that I will not be indifferent to you know, the ways other beings live.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, folks, I'm going to give you a pause here. So it's just about 11 o'clock. So why don't you go up and have a cup of tea, have a toilet break, and then come back at 11:05? Generosity, the giving of material things. So this simply means giving possessions, things that we have, whether it's food, clothing, money, whatever, and when it's appropriate to do so. And you can also give things that you don't own as well, which is sort of like, you know, in the public sphere. Like, for instance, cleaning up the environment in some way. So Helene was just talking about the dog park. You know, some people don't clean up after their dogs, but you could. You know, there's lots of these things now where people go and they clean up the creeks. So this is also a gift to others. Another simple way you can do this is also mentally. So when we go outside and we really enjoy the weather, you can give the weather to others. Just as I'm able to enjoy the weather, may all beings enjoy this beautiful weather today. You can also give your work, your time, your interest, these types of things. They all come under this thing called giving material things. Giving others your energy or helping them have more energy. In other words, by giving them encouragement. All of these come under this category of giving material things. Another thing that you can give, which when I read this, I thought, wow, that's what my mother did, is when you give your family to others. So what's this mean? Well, for instance, what do you call that practice at Christmas time? Orphans? So you know, when people don't have a lot of friends, then you invite them to your place to come over for Christmas dinner. So I remember when I was growing up, we had a neighbor and she suffered from multiple sclerosis and she had two young children. So when Christmas time came for their house, their mother wasn't able to do anything, prepare any Christmas dinner or anything like that. So my mum always got us to go over there and invite the youngest children to come over to our place to have Christmas dinner. So I'm sure you guys have probably done something like that too. So this follows under the practice of giving material things. Other ways of doing it, of course, is when you perhaps meet a stranger or a foreigner in the city and that they don't know how to get somewhere. Simple one also is to give coins or notes or whatever you can afford to those if you find begging in the streets. Also, like I say, around Christmas time or something, you have people in Australia or in Brisbane who are foreigners that don't know the customs and so forth, to invite one of them back to your home for Christmas to show them this is how we celebrate Christmas and what it means to us here. These are different forms of giving material. So now we're going to go a bit more in depth to this, and this will take this week and next week as well. So it's got three headings from the Lamrim Chenmo. So the first of these is how to give, and then what to do when you find yourself unable to give, and the remedies that you can apply to help yourself get over the giving of material things. So our first thing we're going to look at is how to give away material things. And in this, there are four parts. The recipients of giving, those who you give to. And in this teaching, there are 10 of them. Then the motivation that we should bring to the act of giving, how to actually give, and the things to give. So Geshe Sopa says in brief, we should practice generosity towards all other sentient beings without any discrimination. And there aren't any exceptions. But here, we're dividing sentient beings into 10 categories, taking into account our usual attitudes towards others. What he means is that ordinarily we have a positive attitude towards some and a negative attitude towards others. We see some as our friends, others as unlikable, some who are beneath us, and still others we see as being better than us, superiors. So to clarify how a bodhisattva should practice, we're going to look at how we can calmly divide sentient beings. And once you recognize all of these sentient beings as objects of generosity, then it shows you how to think about them, how to consider them, how to properly give to them, and how to dedicate for them. So let's have a look at some of these. So we're going to look at, first of all, I think the first five of the 10 recipients of giving. So Khyentse Rinpoche said something quite interesting about this. So I took it out of the commentary that he said. He says, just like Geshe Sopa, it's probably easier to think of all sentient beings. And this presentation of the 10 recipients of giving pretty much includes everyone. So why is it broken up into these 10 categories? These first five and the five on the next page. So Geshe was saying Lama Tsongkhapa is quite unique in the way that he lays out things in order to benefit our mind. Geshe also said that when we go to practice these things, if we follow the way he has described and apply the instructions that he's given, then we can bring out the main and important features and come to some really good realizations. So the point of dividing all sentient beings in these 10 categories is actually to bring about a sense of change in us. And so instead of saying all sentient beings, he goes, no, we're going to break it all up here to 10. And if you do it this way, your mind will actually change. So this is very similar to his advice in terms of practicing, like for instance, love and kindness. So in his text there, he said, if you just practice love and kindness to all sentient beings by saying to yourself, may all sentient beings be happy. may they all have the causes of happiness. And think of like all beings. Very little will change in your mind. Because the one day that's going to happen is the person that you don't like will do something, and you will not be thinking then, he will not be included with an all sentient beings. You'll drop them out. So in the practice of loving kindness, he asks us often to start with somebody's actually been kind to us, like our spiritual mentors. Then go to the family. Then go to a stranger, and then finally towards somebody who's hurt us. And to take each one of them separately and spend time becoming really familiar with the idea that this person does want to be happy, don't they? And they can actually be happy, can't they? So may they be happy. So it's a similar type of thing that he's doing here. He's saying, don't just think I'll be generous to all sentient beings, because it won't actually help us do that. We will still stay in the category of friends, enemies, and strangers. So in this presentation, the first five, so the first three divisions of sentient beings are those who are dear to us and friends who help us, the enemies who harm us, and those towards whom we feel neutral, because in this life at least, we haven't recognized that they've done anything to either help or harm us. Now, when bodhisattvas in training, like ourselves, or even actual bodhisattvas, should never ever give a gift or give something to someone thinking, this person is my friend, they've done so much for me. So I should qualify that by saying, if he says that to some and not to others, this is not the way to practice the perfection of generosity. If you gave to everyone and said, this person is my friend, they've done so much for me, meaning you go down and you go, friends and relatives, yep, now the enemy. This person is my friend. They have done so much for me. If that attitude is not there, then having the attitude of giving to your friends and relatives, oh, this is my friend, they've done so much for me, that would be a mistake. One shouldn't give like that. So you can see here how important the preliminaries to the perfections are, can't you? Because without practicing equanimity, loving kindness, compassion beforehand to actually generate the mind of enlightenment, we won't be able to do this. So this is the fourth quality here, are those with good qualities. So those people who have pure moral conduct or excellent knowledge. And the fifth group is those who have various flaws. So the flaws that he's mentioning here are those who have, like for instance, abandoned their practices. Those who have broken their vows. So sometimes people trust us enough to tell us that this is what they've actually done, that they don't do these practices anymore. They haven't, been doing the sadhanas. They have abandoned some of the vows. So these people still have to be objects of our generosity. So what forms of generosity do you think you can extend to those who have flaws, those who have broken their vows, those who have abandoned their practices? Any ideas?
I can't see anybody waving their hand, Eddie, because of the screen there.
Oh, okay. Any ideas? So, it's not easy to practice Dharma. And I'm sure many of us have fallen off the wagon. It's very easy to fall off the wagon taking high Shloka Tantra commitments. Very easy. Right? And oftentimes, I think that people don't want to share that. they might feel a bit ashamed or a bit embarrassed that they're actually not doing the practices that they committed themselves to doing. It's not uncommon. Biffy, you were saying?
Rosemary has something.
Okay, Rosemary?
You'd offer them compassion, wouldn't you? And Tong Len, so that, you know, taking on yourself the impacts of breaking your vow.
Yep, you could certainly do that. Another thing that Bruce has said, which is very, very useful, and that I've done in the past, I know Mickey has done also, is to agree with others that, yes, and guess what, I've done the same. If you have done it, then let them know that you've done that too. Also know how you've let them climb but got back on, right? And so you can also get back on. You can resume your practice. Like I said, one of the terrible things about this is the guilt that people have about doing something like this. And that guilt prevents them actually resuming practice. So if we're a practitioner in that type of vehicle, we can also say, yep, I've done the same, but I'm right now. And this is what you can do. And then you can say, oh, this is what Lama Zopa said about that. Or in fact, this is what the Dalai Lama has said about that. Because it's not an uncommon thing to do.
Linda had something.
Yep, Linda.
Yeah, when that happened to me, and I told a few Dharma friends, and they sent me all this information, particularly one of the monks sent me all these things that you could repair them with and how you could, ensure that you didn't do it again, and also shortened versions that you could put into the practice that you had. So it was really, really valuable. And like Bruce was saying, for people to say, yeah, I did it as well, you know, we've all done it, so... That was always really good.
Yeah, it is, especially like you're saying, Linda, when you get instructions on how you might be able to abbreviate the practice. You know, but sometimes I think many times what happens is that it just seems too much to do. Or, you know, we're just like time pressed. But whatever, we've got, you know, reasons for doing it. So it's also very good to, if you can trust the person enough, to explain your reasons for dropping the practice. Because there may be solutions for that.
Rachel, you had something?
I know someone who broke their highest tantra, yoga tantra vows as well. Mm. They definitely had a lot of guilt and kind of like, they were like, scared to get back into it again because they're scared that they're going to break them again, that sort of thing. And she said that just support, encouragement was like the best thing, and just a reminder that every single day that you have the vows is a good thing, even if you break them you can always repair them, that sort of thing. And just try to focus on that positive instead of the guilt and I've broken my vows.
You know, so some of you, especially from the old Lam Rim class that we used to do downstairs, you know, there's, if we don't study, it's quite natural to feel guilty about this and then to not resume. And what I think is going on there, that people don't actually understand what it means to hold a vow, to take a vow and to hold a vow. So without study, most of us think that, first of all, I can't take this practice because I won't be able to hold the vow. I take that vow, I can't hold it. I can't do the practice. That's one thing. So that prevents you taking the practice. Others will take the vow and the practice that goes with it, and then break the vow, and then feel very bad about doing that. But in both instances, I would suggest that person does not know what it means to take a vow. Now, for those of you who've studied, you know, at our Lam Rim Chenmo class, you know, I'm sure most of you will remember that when we the term taking vows really means that you know how to repair vows. Mm. You know how to repair breakages, because that's what you're going to do. There isn't anyone who's been given a vow or a series of vows and were able to keep them just get from the get-go. Say, yep, I'll take them and never, ever break them. The whole essential thing to understand about accepting a vow, taking a vow, is knowing when they're broken, how you break them, and how to repair them.
Mm.
So taking vows is really about the knowledge that you need to repair them, not the fact that you're going to break them. That's already understood.
Eddie, so Bruce has said he always liked the story about a teacher who kept interrupting his journey to purify because he'd broken his vows like falling rain, which is kind of nice, because it's like even a teacher broke his vows. And I also think of, you know, Geshe Zopa, when he's teaching on Sundays, and he gives this incredible generosity of being just like us. And he'll talk about the amazing practitioners, da la la, and then he'll say, but people like us. Mm. And he includes himself in people like us to kind of give us real encouragement in it's okay to not be perfect yet, that we're, you know, on this journey.
Yeah. So the example that Bruce gave is a very good one, because, when Atisha was asked to come to Tibet to impart the teachings, Atisha at that time was India's greatest scholar, greatest practitioner scholar. And the story going that he was given an elephant to ride from India to Tibet. And on the way, he would keep breaking vows and stopping the elephant and getting off and doing three prostrations and then repairing the vow. And he'd get back up on the elephant and move on a bit, and then he'd do it again and get off. So, you know, like you'd think, well, how can he be breaking vows? He's just sitting on top of an elephant. What's he doing? But so he said, no, I don't break any of my Pratamoksha vows. I don't break any of the vows of being a monk, or my individual liberation vows. None of those are broken. I don't break my bodhisattva vows either. They're firm. He says, but tantric downfalls, they're like rain. They just pour down. Because Hayasaya Tantra is really about the mind. So he'd have these thoughts, things would come across his mind. He'd go, oh, I shouldn't have that type of thought. Oh, whoops, I've just forgotten that actually I'm a deity sitting on the elephant. Everybody around me is a pure living being. Whoops, forgot. Have to get down, do my business. So you can see here, he's repairing his vow over and over and over. Mm. So for those of us or people you know who might be engaged in the higher shogas, Robin has pointed out that, you know, you're like, okay, it's very easy to break them. You've got two things you need to know. How to repair it, and then why was it broken? One of the most simplest ways it's broken, you just forget. It's not some big deal. You just forget. Other times, it's you're really pressed for time.
Yes, Biffy? Jeanette has something.
Jeanette?
Well, I just wanted to say, I remember we were at a teaching by His Holiness down, it was either Melbourne or Sydney, and before he started his teaching, he had to do a purification practice because on the way to the arena, he'd either broken a vow or he'd had some thought that he thought he had to purify.
Mm-hmm.
I think you and Biffy were at that one as well. Because
right.
I thought, wow, we've actually seen His Holiness doing a purification practice. It was amazing.
That's right. It's amazing. So, so Rachel or anybody else who knows of anyone else who's broken vows and feels discouraged, you might tell them about that. You know, even one time His Holiness was on the way to a teaching, and the teaching had to be held up for a little bit because he had to purify his broken vow. And also the story of Atisha is a wonderful one.
Also, Eddie, I think just being able to fess up and say, yes, I too have fallen off the wagon, that is an act of generosity, because you put aside your pride and, giving someone confidence rather than putting a barrier between yourself and others.
Yeah. Yeah. So, there's a lot of people, when they read about Hayasoka Tantra, there's a lot of stuff about going to the lower realms and be staying in different hell realms for so many long years because you've broken these vows. And that's one of the major reasons people don't even want to take the vows in the first place. But you've got to remember, like it all can be purified. It all can be, there isn't anything that can't stop you becoming enlightened. So Robin's written down, it's very hard to confess to perfect people. Well, you won't find any perfect people, Robin. Don't look for them. You'll never confess to perfect people. So you've got to confess to those who are not perfect. But those who have enough openness, like, for instance, there's Miffy and I, we're both, you can go, look, I want to say this. I want to tell somebody that I've actually done this and relieve myself of the heaviness. Okay, let's have a look now at the next five people. So, what should I do?
Oh, Eddie, just before you go on, actually, when we're looking at these 10 different groups of people, probably the only time in my life where I've had this experience of pretty much all of them all at once was when my mother Inta died, and she had, all of these things that she wanted to give to people at her death but hadn't quite organized them. So there was a whole house of objects, and it was kind of like my job to be able to find a thing to give to each person, each of her students. Mm-hmm. And so, a whole vast range of types of people and everything, and some I got on with and some I didn't. So I had to, it was really this thing of being careful of having, to give to the people that I liked, the ones I didn't, regardless,
That's
it was
right.
quite a good experience, and probably the only time I've been able to do it as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So here have another group of five people. So the first one, those that we hold to be inferior. So this is a result of our conceit or our arrogance. So we can look down on those who we think have fewer good qualities than ourselves. So you see this often in the cities, if you see people are quite dirty and down on their luck and they're asking for money. So just because they look that way, or even if they're a different race, people just turn away. So the seventh and eighth qualities are also determined by judging others in terms of ourselves. We can feel quite competitive towards those who are our equals, and we feel jealous of those who are our superiors. The ninth group here, those who are rich and happy. They have wealth. They have wealth and happiness. And last, of course, are those who are actually miserable and poor. So these are five groups of people that we can be generous towards. And just to see, like, every sentient being fits into one of these categories. And we usually pick and choose among them. We want to be generous to some and not to others. But the practice of the Bodhisattva is to give equally, treating all sentient beings with love and compassion. So I think when we see those who are miserable and destitute, it's not so hard to feel love and compassion towards them. But when those are rich and happy, it might be a little bit more difficult, right, for us. Like, for instance, you know, there's a lot of CEOs in our culture, and a lot of politicians who appear to be quite happy, and they're certainly rich. And, you know, what do we give them? And not only that, but, like, how do we give it to them? So most of us, I'm sure, don't even want to give anything to them. So, you know, we leave them out. Those who are superior to us, often there too, we think, well, what do we need to give them? They're better than us. So here he's sort of asking us once again to have a sense of equanimity towards all. And I think the easiest sort of equanimity here we can bring to mind is that if you think that none of these groups of five people, none of these categories of five people are enlightened, then you know that they don't have the best form of happiness. So we can wish them to have that happiness. We'll also know that all of them are suffering. There's, I love this, one of the sayings in the Labyrinth is that, you know, those who are rich are, have the, suffer the misery of holding on to their wealth and getting more. Okay? While those who are poor suffer the agonies of the body. So the rich suffer mentally and the poor suffer physically. And where they're rich or where they're miserable, the Dharma would certainly help them. Yeah? And if we don't want to have, want them to be enlightened, then we're not really practicing the perfection of generosity. Because remember, the practice of generosity is mental. It's primarily mental. It's not about really giving the physical stuff. If you can, of course, do so. If it's the right time, it's the right thing to do, and you have the resources, of course, give. But the most important thing is to want to give to them. You know, so to want to give to our Prime Minister, for instance, understanding of the Dharma, to give to the man we call, you know, Mr. Trump. You know, they're certainly rich. I don't know who's too happy. But those people certainly need Dharma in their lives.
So, Eddie, I've got a question. If giving our goodwill towards these people, is that a little bit like giving loving kindness, like, or just trying to generate goodwill or give goodwill to them rather than resentment?
Oh, yeah, that's for sure. We want to give our goodwill. And yeah, look, one of the major reasons, you know, to have a goodwill towards others is for us to remember that the suffering is not intrinsic to our nature. But suffering is adventitious, it just comes and goes. So people can actually be the best persons that they could be. They could actually be enlightened. So we should acknowledge that and have a sense of goodwill towards them. You know, it's like, you know, sometimes when you see people who behave badly, then in response to their bad behavior, we lose our goodwill, don't we? Why do we lose our goodwill?
Well, we've kind of just forgotten. We're just looking at them as ordinary instead of forgotten that everybody needs the Dharma, or that maybe we can't see who they really are.
Well, I was saying, you know, one thing here is, first of all, that we cling to the appearance of this bad behavior as being the bad person, right? So the self-grasping arises immediately. We see them as being, having an intrinsic nature, when they don't have that nature. What we forget is that right now they're overcome by suffering. The conditions for suffering have arisen. They have the causes on their mind stream. They experience suffering. When people experience suffering, often they behave badly. They're not in control. They never were in control. And now the lack of control really presents itself to us. So can we have enough goodwill to understand that that's what's happening to them and to wish them to be free of it? Now, do we see a person who's suffering, or do we see an angry, miserable person? So if we forget our Dharma, we won't see them as suffering. We'll see them as being angry and miserable and don't want to have anything to do with them. So even the sense of generosity that we have, our goodwill, our wish for them to become enlightened, vanishes. Now, of course, I think this is going to keep happening to us all the time. We are going to be going up and down like a yo-yo. We're not going to have a steady attitude towards any of them. And there's no need to feel bad about this. Because if you ask yourself, as Robin said, like, why is that happening? Well, why is it? Anybody, why is our mind up and down like a yo-yo? Why is it that we don't have this perfection of generosity? The answer is really simple.
We're not enlightened.
We're trapped in samsara.
Okay, that's one answer.
We're under the influence of karma.
I'm sorry?
I said we're under the influence of karma.
Yep, these are all answers, but it's not the answer I'm looking for.
Helene?
Right.
I was going to say, I'm not a Buddha yet.
No, that's true too, but stop there. Anyone else?
Linda?
No, I would have just said we're not enlightened, still afflicted by karma and delusions.
Yeah. Well, the answer I suggest is none of us have trained in it yet. It's really simple. We haven't done the work. All the rest follows. We haven't done the work and then we're not enlightened. Haven't done the work. We haven't trained ourselves, first of all, trying to become equanimous with others, seeing others as just the same as we are. We are equal in that we wish to be free from suffering and we're not. And so what keeps us in suffering? You're right, karma, delusions. That's true. Why do we have karma and delusions? Still have them. And the answer is we haven't worked against them. We haven't trained our mind to drop them. That's all. It will always come down to that. We just haven't trained ourselves. So I think that's really, to hold on to that, to go. And it's just the same as everyone else. Everyone else is in samsara. Yep, why are you there? Karma and delusion. Why do you have karma and delusion? That's the first two noble truths, isn't it? I'm suffering. Why? Through karma and delusion. What puts an end to it? The path that brings about the cessation of it. So we haven't trained ourselves on a path yet. We're still, I think, on the level of just getting the information, thinking about it occasionally, just trying to do our best while we are. Still gathering information and still reflecting and agreeing on a whole lot of stuff, but we're trying to do our best. But we haven't actually trained ourselves.
So that's why I'm good at art and bad at piano as well.
That's right. It's the same thing for everything, right? If you want to find yourself good at anything, it's because you train it. You get professional assistance and then you start doing the work. Actually, I'll say to Miffy, I've just finished reading a biography of a poker player, and he was saying there's more money to be won on the golf courses in America than there are in the casinos. So many of the gamblers are all now they always go to the golf courses now, right? But of course they're not very good players, so they lose heaps of money in the beginning. But then he found that some of them don't. He said, so what happens? He said, within 1 year, he found that some of these players had improved their golf game by 20 strokes. That's massive, right? So how did they come to do that? Any ideas?
Practice.
Yes, they all, yeah. They bought themselves a coach.
Ah.
Each of them went and got a professional coach and practiced. That's how they got better. Now, we also have a professional coach, don't we? They're called gurus, lamas. They give us the advice. They tell us what to do. But then perhaps we don't practice or train ourselves as well as we possibly could. You know, we don't really get in touch with them and say, okay, yeah, I've been doing this for this long and this is what happened. But we don't get feedback from them. And, you know, you do definitely need feedback if you want to get good at anything. You need to have a good art teacher beside you to give you advice and do the stroke this way. And why don't you try that? And da, da, da. It's the same with golf coaches and tennis coaches. They give you feedback. They watch what you do and they tell you how you could do better and to restrain yourself doing this and that. So probably for most of us, we don't do that with our Dharma practice. You know, most of us are probably like reading sadhanas or saying prayers, reciting verses, memorizing things, this like that. But then when it actually comes to train, it's like, yeah, how do I, you know, this is not so clear. So I often give, you know, the advice often for training is to first of all, listen to the teachings, you know. So we're doing that. We're reading and we're listening. Then the next bit says, then reflect upon them, meaning think about them. So probably most of us do, but not in a very sort of a vigorous way, rigorous and vigorous way. And then if you ask yourself, what type of mind do we bring to our reflection? Then we'll find that it's not a very stable mind. You know, we don't, our reflection might be a minute. So at present, our mind is not a very good tool to use to train ourselves with the new knowledge we're getting. So, yeah, we have at the moment teachings by Glenn Svensson that are given, what nights are they? I think Monday and Fridays, I think. Right, so these are teachings because whatever we do here, the training of the mind is done by the mind. Right, so we need to actually learn, like, how do you do that? So we also need to learn relaxation techniques and then using mindfulness and introspection to actually sort of sharpen but also stabilize the mind. So that's our internal work. Then we also know our mind goes up and down independent upon the different situations we meet and the people we meet. So that means equanimity. So Robin's written, how about coaches or gurus who we can't directly ask? So then you have the texts. So this is what the Buddha said. You know, when that was the concern. Who's going to be our teacher when the Buddha has gone? And he said the Dharma. So this is not a new problem. This has gone on for years and years and years, even within the Tibetan traditions. There isn't in the Tibetan group, it's very, 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 very rare that somebody will live right next door to their teacher and ask them and get advice going on like this. What will often take place is the teacher will give you advice or you get the advice from the book and you go and practice it and you use your introspection to see how your mind is going. The other thing with Lam Rim especially is that you should already have an idea of the quality of mind you're trying to develop. It's not like we're going blind into this. The solution's already there. You know, so like for instance, when you meditate on equanimity, for instance, like what's the result of that? If you don't know the result, it's like so what are you doing with your mind? What's your path? What's your goal here? So you can't be lazy about trying to be happy. Now, you can be really lazy about trying to be happy when you're looking outside yourself to be happy. That's the lazy way. Let the world provide us with my happiness. It's really lazy and it doesn't work.
Jeanette,
if it doesn't work, we'll have to be disciplined about like going inward. And then we're going to find a real crazy mind. Right? Then we're nuts. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Now, how do I stop being nuts? How do I learn to look after myself? So, you know, we've got to sort of slow down, learn to relax, recognize different states of mind, apply the different antidotes, and then gradually, you know, go, okay, now I have to stop my social reactivity, my desirous attachment to, you know, my selfishness that's just about me and my friends, my aversion towards people I don't like, and my complete indifference towards others. So we can read a lot about equanimity, and then we try and put it into place when we're out there in the world. And then when we sit down to meditate, we're looking really at what is the nature of the mind, what's its state as we're trying to practice this equanimity.
Jeanette had a question.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can.
I just wanted to say, Miffy, I could never come to nighttime classes at Langmuir because I don't have a problem with nighttime classes, just being tired. But I signed up for Glenn Svensson's classes, and the class on Friday, I fell asleep, completely asleep, about four times. I'm no joking. I couldn't believe it. And every time I woke up, I thought, oh, no, I've done it again.
Yeah.
And then I thought about the hook of mindfulness, the rope of mindfulness, and then the hook of introspection.
Yeah.
Then I said to myself, I'm not going to fall asleep again. And I did it four times. I missed basically all of that class on Friday.
Okay.
And I was going to give up. I says, that's hopeless. I'm just no good at night time. But okay. No, I've changed my mind. I'm going to listen tomorrow night.
You got to go. Yep, like I said, did you watch the course before this one, Jeanette?
No.
Okay.
I didn't have the internet then.
Okay. So there's a really good advice given in that series about sleepiness and tiredness. So when you find yourself falling asleep often, one of the most obvious reasons for doing that is you're tired. Right. So that means you just have to get more rest or sleep before you go to the teaching. That's the simplest thing you can do. Right?
I thought about that.
Yeah. So it's great you brought this up because this is what happens to us, right? We have hindrances, obstacles arise. If they're not brought out into the open, then we really can't deal with them. So the simplest one with tiredness is to get more sleep. And what I normally do, I'm not a coffee drinker, but often before a teaching comes, like on Sundays, I often do the same with Geshe's Opa. I sit there and he says, you're snoring. And I go, yeah, but I can hear him. And then what often happens, I go, look, don't sit on the bed or sit on the bed, have a cup of coffee beforehand.
Yeah, well, the first problem was I had to go into the bedroom to listen to the teaching and I sat on my bed because Wally was watching soccer.
Yeah.
So I had to go in there to get privacy and I knew that was a bad idea from the start.
Yeah.
And plus the fact that I'm not good at night time. I'm a very tired person. Sure.
But also, Jeanette, the ironic thing about this is even if you do fall asleep, you woke up four times, you fell asleep four times. And you woke up four times and you were actually using your mindfulness and introspection to even notice that the whole thing happened. It's just, you know, it was an epic battle, but you were actually using those two tools anyway.
That's right. Congratulating myself for that. But you're right, it was an epic battle. It was awful. It was really, really, I don't know how to describe it. It was just, it was terrible.
No, actually, that's funny you say that, because I remember there's a great little spiffy saying of the Kadampas. He said, look, if you're not actually fighting the delusions, what practice of Dharma are you doing? So that's the major thing. That's what it's about. It's noticing the different states of our mind and trying to improve them. It's often a battle.
Yeah.
So, you know, rather... yeah, and the thing is that we are often not on the objects that we decide to put our mind on. But if you can bring it back to it, that's the victory. That's all you've got to do.
Mm.
It's like the breaking the vows. All you've got to do is retake it.
Just a bit disappointed in myself, that's all.
Yeah.
But that the disappointment comes from, you know, putting in the effort and kind of, you know, failing in that little microcosm of the class. But actually the big picture is you're actually doing the practice. So in terms of the whole practice, it's a massive success.
Oh, yeah. All right.
Yeah, there's another thing too, you know, how you make the growth requires the failure. Right. No one gets good at anything until they fail at it and then they have another shot at it. The progress is made of failure after failure after failure. Right. It's not just like fail and that's it. If you do that, yeah, you fail, all right. You stop, you know, you stop. But the progress is made through failing and starting again, failing, starting again, failing and starting again. If you look at any weightlifter who builds their body, that's how it's done.
Okay.
It goes down, rest, oh, now up, effort again, now relax, effort again, relax. So it's just to continue, it's just that process. Wow, okay, this is good. So I've really enjoyed this. I mean, it's great having this back and forth in conversation in this type of class. We have come to the end of it. This is all I wanted to cover today. So this was this other thing I thought, so we've gone into it in more detail than we originally did in the class downstairs. And that's what's going to happen more and more in these classes. So we'll do less, but we'll go into more depth. So what I mean by less is, instead of covering a whole lot of material so it's quite wide and you forget the whole lot, I'm going to try and do less, but do it a bit more intensely with, you know, discussion like this and relying on different texts and so forth. So it will take us longer, but I hope that there'll be sort of less to forget. You know? So as before we finish, I'd first like to ask you, so what were without looking at notes or anything, what were the three types of generosity we focused on today?
Giving the Dharma.
Giving the Dharma was the first one, was it? What was the second one?
Fearlessness.
Giving fearlessness.
Oh, sorry.
Giving, what's that? And the last?
Materials.
Materials. So these are the three things. And then when we looked at the recipients of giving, how many were there?
Ten.
Okay, that's enough. That's all on the plate. Right, you know, okay. And in general, if you look at those 10 recipients, how could you categorize them in general? A simple way of categorizing them.
Friend, enemy, strangers.
Excellent, that's right. Those who we hold close, those who we don't care about, and those we are averse to. So those 10 are just within that category. Excellent.
Eddie, I'm a bit mixed up with the one that you said, feeling jealous of those who are superior.
Yeah, yeah.
What does that mean? I don't get that.
So it can be the case, Jeanette. So, you know, so sometimes, suppose, like Glenn, right? So Glenn's a lay person. And then he gives a teaching, and then you might be sitting there listening to him. And so, you know, I don't know whether you know this or not, but like he did the 8-year course, and there's quite like it. You could meet lay people who've been in the Buddha Dharma for 20 years and have got many, maybe they've gone to university, maybe they've gone and done the 8-year course and so forth. And they are superior to us in their knowledge and probably in their practice too.
All right.
Right? But you're sitting there and then they start teaching it and then you start looking for fault in them. You know, or you become critical of them. So as an example, many, many years ago when I was in New Zealand, and I was just a kid going up, they brought one of the great Hindu teachers to New Zealand. And they had him on television, and he just poked his nose. He was just sitting there interviewing, and the guy just goes like this. And that's all that anybody ever commented on. That's all they saw. That's all they focused on.
But also, Eddie, what can often happen is that, you know, someone like Glenn, who has all of these incredible qualifications and is clearly an amazing practitioner, and, you know, for us, if we fall asleep in the class, so instead of kind of just going, wow, how amazing is Glenn, we get really despondent and go, oh, I'm nothing like Glenn, or I'll never be able to do it. So instead of rejoicing about it, we're not necessarily overtly resentful about it, but
but this is about being jealous towards them.
Yeah.
This is really referring to jealousy towards them. So that's really referring to like their qualities and you thinking that otherwise that you're much better than them, or that you find the faults and you point those out. It doesn't have to only be to anyone else. It could be just to yourself. So this could be to like lay people and also the ordained. So, you know, many people, like if someone else is around you, they might not even know that this is how you feel. This is, like I said, up to us. You have to sort of keep examining how your mind is responding to the stimuli and going, shit, is that jealousy? Or is that my pride that I think this and that? Is this aversion? These sort of things.
Oh, right.
Was that helpful, Jeanette?
Yes. Since I've been coming to Langri Tangpa, I don't suffer from jealousy much at all. That's why I was kind of wondering about it. I used to be a jealous person, but I can say I'm really not at all now. So that's why I was wondering about it.
Thank you, thank you.
Because I was sitting here saying it myself. I don't really think I'm jealous of anything. I'm
quite
content.
Be careful of that, because Miffy used to think that in me too. It's just we haven't run into the conditions yet.
That's right. And I mean, there is a thing being at Langri Tangpa Centre. There's like a joke amongst some admins about having centre jealousy. So that, you know, when you hear about another centre having amazing windfall or having some incredible lamas come to visit, and instead of going, wow, I'm so happy for them, there's a little voice that goes, oh, I wish it had have happened to us. So,
yeah, but that's just human nature. But if you can cut it off and don't think about it like that anymore, if you just have that one little thought and then you get rid of it,
that's
great.
Right. Rejoice about it. But what happens is the object of jealousy shifts, and it can be quite tricky because you might think, oh, I'm free of jealousy, but actually it's just shifted to just different objects. Chris?
Hey.
Chris, your microphone.
Just my contribution to that is I just find that with the afflictive emotions, as you think you're making progress, they tend to become more sophisticated and subtle in how they sort of manifest. Just regarding the jealousy one, a very quick one is that, you know, those of you with children or even adults around sport, is that all of the parents tend to, and talking about superiority, tend to really focus on the most gifted kids and try and pull out their weaknesses, for example. And the underlying emotion, though, even though these kids are superior to everybody else's, the parents pretend that they have all these weaknesses, and the basis is their jealousy. And it's of the kid's ability and all the rest of it. And it's something, it's a trap I've fallen into myself. And so, yeah, it manifests in different ways, and it tends to be more sophisticated.
Yeah, well, this is what you find, Chris, with the practice of Dharma. So we deal with what they call the gross afflictions. So we have to be sort of introduce them through the text and talk and the definitions and stuff, and we go, oh, that's what that is. So that it becomes quite obvious to us that these are them, right? But once you start sitting down and actually meditating, boy, oh boy, then you find that underneath all that is just all this bubbling along and bubbling along. And they're not just up there. They go they go down, right? So we also have, and that's the big thing with the Middleway Consequence School in particular. They talk about subtle obscurations, subtle afflictive obscurations. So you've got gross jealousy, then jealousies that you're unaware of, but you become aware of them through your practice of resting the mind. But yeah, so it's not just on one level here. And as if you also put out, you can be jealous towards some people, some situations, and then you're not at other times and you think you're doing fine, but actually you're not. It's just the conditions have changed.
Just a while ago, Eddie, Bruce had also mentioned that kind of self-grasping leads to stinginess. So that's on that more subtle kind of level.
That's right. Yeah, there's the self grasping and the self-cherishing, Bruce. This is right. You know, so yeah, on the gross level, you know, like in the other, in the Pali tradition and the non-Mahayana, self-cherishing is not a problem. It's the gross afflictions like anger and aversion and the hatred and the desirous attachment, you know, and the complete indifference to others. They're the problems. But the Mahayanas go, well, actually, the problems are deeper than that. It comes down to self-cherishing. These are just aspects of self-cherishing. And if you really go deeper than that, they go, they're just aspects of self-grasping. So I've got gross afflictions, subtle afflictions, self-cherishing, self-grasping. So yeah, it's a bit of work. At least it's very interesting work, isn't it? Because we're working, you know, really about with ourselves, trying to become better people, and that's really just about mind work. So I think that's you know, it's great we're all interested in it and are trying to do it. Okay, guys, we're going to finish up now. I'll just take these last few slides and show you where we are. So these are the divisions we did tonight, the teachings, fearlessness and material things, as you all answered correctly. Here's where I've been drawing information from. If you have these texts, have a look at them. So pages 122 to 123 in the Lamrim Chenmo Volume 2, that dealt with the practice of giving Dharma, or giving teachings, giving fearlessness, and giving material things. It's also covered in pages 11 to 27, Six Perfections by Lama Zopa. Four pages in Steps on the Path by Geshe Zopa. And for those of you who have the Lamrim Chenmo commentary by Geshe Tashi Tsering, was in Teaching 30. And now next week we're going to be looking at the motivation for giving. So this will be completely new material. So for those of you who were studying with me downstairs, we haven't covered this before. So if you do have the commentary, Teaching 31, have a look at it. Might give you some sort of foundation for the coming up teachings. Other than that, we're going to be looking at the perfection of giving. So let's finish off by dedicating the merit we've gathered. So due to the past, present and future merits, which are like a dream and exist in mere name, created by ourselves, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and all sentient beings that exist in mere name, may we attain enlightenment, which doesn't exist from its own side, but does exist in, its, in name, for the sake of all living beings, and bring them to enlightenment as quickly as possible by ourselves alone. And so thank you very much.
Thank you.
Rachel, I was going to, if you're still open, I could just offer you a little, just something I thought of about your problem that you're having with different members of the family. And you were saying that both sides always want to be right, from your perspective, right? They never want to be wrong and they both think they are right. Ask them to solve the problem where they both get what they want.
Yeah, it's not possible.
Well, I'm just saying that. Ask him to do it. Say, look, you think you're right? You're right? Give me, provide a solution where you both get what you want.
I'll write a letter and it'll make them change their mind. And it's like, oh.
So would you be big-hearted enough to solve it where they both get what you want, or that you're both prepared to drop off from what you want? Because people do that sometimes, but yeah, they've got to care enough about the other person to do it.
Yeah.
And that's what Miffy was bringing out. You know, we've got to care enough about ourselves as a family to go forward, rather than hurting one whole group. You know, just to get your advantage.
Yeah.
Which I think that's what we're trying to prevent, isn't family, it?
Would they rather their ideas?
Yeah. Anyway, I'm finished up. Everyone, it's lovely to see you all. Good to see you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks, Eddie. Thanks, Eddie. Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Bye. Bye.